Okay, I would like to welcome you to today's event, the Frameworks event, focusing on DIO biomarkers. My name is Rainer Fischer. I'm the CEO and CSIO of the IBRI. Would like to welcome you here, so don't worry, you will not hear too much about me. Just want to welcome you briefly to the IBRI premises here in the IU building, and I would directly pass on to Vanessa Bart, who volunteered and agreed to take the lead and the coordination and the meeting lead today. Vanessa?
Thank you for that introduction, Rainer. Welcome again, and good morning. I think we have a little bit weather today than the last time we had a Frameworks, which was, again, hosted at the IBRI. So I want to say thank you to Rainer and his staff and team for having two BioCrossroads Frameworks back-to-back, and also in particular to a woman sitting in the back of the room, Natalie Stoll, who I believe kind of ended up in the hot seat coordinating a couple of these events. So thank you, Natalie. Also, we've got a fantastic lineup of speakers. I think that you'll notice from their biographies, we've got a really nice set of diverse backgrounds speaking today. And so I also want to say thank you to Jo Beth Zimmerman and to Dan Robertson for also helping pull that lineup together. So moving on, I also want to send out regrets. I know that David Johnson really wanted to be here. He's a very passionate and enthusiast supporter of sciences, life sciences, and technology, and how those merge together. And I think he really also has a vision for the opportunity for our community to play in that space here in the Indianapolis area, as well as statewide. So when I look to all the folks who are going to be sitting in the audience and we kind of get a rundown of your names and your institutions, what I think is really unique about this space of digital biomarkers is the opportunity to collaborate. And so if we think about what's going on in this space and all the opportunity that's out there, it's not something that a single organization or a single person can lift on their own. And so as we're sitting here in the room hearing this fabulous content, make sure to network afterwards and think about where are the opportunities to collaborate and move this space forward. That being said, I was also asked to introduce myself. I'm Vanessa Barth. I'm with Eli Lilly and Company. I am on loan, hopefully, for the next 2 years to Dr. Rainer and also the IBR staff as well as BioCrossroads. And so my goal is really how to create additional awareness, open up communication, how do we play together, how do we do science together, and how do we build that trust so that we can tackle some of these larger projects and help build our local scientific and technology ecosystem. So moving on to the heart of the conversation, we have four fantastic speakers. I'm going to try and do all of their biographies justice, but they are in the program, so please make sure to peruse that because there's a lot of fascinating details about the individuals. First, you're going to hear from Brad Lamb. He started off at Penn, where he got his PhD. He moved on to Johns Hopkins for a postdoc. He was over at Case Western Reserve, and we were able to lure him across state lines to Indianapolis, where he is currently the executive director of the Stark Neurosciences Research Institute and holds the Roberts Family Chair in Alzheimer's Disease Research. He's also a professor of medical and molecular genetics at the IU School of Medicine. I think he has really three prongs associated with his research as I was reading through, having to do with translational genetics, looking at microglial and neuronal communication, as well as traumatic brain injury. And the reason I can speak a little bit more about that is because my background's in neuroscience, so I hope to do the others as much justice. After Dr. Lamb, we'll be hearing from Maurice Vincent. He recently joined Lilly. He's been with Lilly for about a year. We welcomed him to our team, and he works with Dr. Mike Irizarry. He received his PhD in Norway and went back to South America to practice. He is a migraine and headache specialist and a neurologist by training. So we welcome you as well. After that, we're going to totally switch gears and go with Chris Economos with PhysIQ. Chris is the Vice President of Business Development. He has been associated across a variety of institutions and has been instrumental in creating healthcare solutions, and I believe it says completing complex transactions. So I'm guessing that means multiple parties involved, and I'm guessing some of those are quite challenging to work with. I feel I can say that because I believe I am employed by one of those sometimes. So you got to be able to poke fun at yourself a little bit. And then lastly, we're going to wrap up with Dan Robertson, who is the Vice President of Digital Biomarkers. He's also Executive Director in the Applied Biosciences space. He started off at Florida State University for his PhD and then moved on to the Naval Academy. So again, please peruse for additional details on their biographies. I'm going to welcome Dr. Lamb to the stage, and I'm really excited about the content and the conversation. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. I think my role here is to set the stage for what's to come. What I wanted to do today was to tell you about some of the challenges, I think, particularly in the neuroscience and neurodegeneration space in particular, that we have in terms of drug development and getting drugs to patients. Let's see here. Hopefully this works. There we go. The biggest issue really is just what we're facing over the next couple of decades, and that there's just dramatically increased incidence of neurodegenerative diseases. Once most of these disorders, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, were considered very rare disorders, these are obviously now increasingly common. And the main reason being is the changes in lifespan that people are living into these ages where these diseases become extremely common. So I'm going to particularly talk about Alzheimer's disease, but again, you could apply this to almost all of the late onset neurological disorders. Alzheimer's disease is irreversible and progressive brain disease that slowly destroys memory and thinking skills. And although it increases in incidence with age, we don't think that it's a normal process of aging. We think this is actually a disease process that occurs that's age dependent. And one of the dramatic things here is just thinking about where we are in terms of are we making impacts in terms of how we treat diseases? And this just shows sort of percentage changes in cause of death between the year 2000 and 2014 across various diseases and disorders, so breast cancer, prostate cancer, heart disease, stroke, HIV, AIDS, and then Alzheimer's disease on the last. And again, this is because, again, of this huge increase, A, in the number of patients who are being diagnosed with the disease, and then B, we don't have any treatments right now really that are at all effective. It is the most common cause of dementia in those over 65. Right now, about 5.2 million in the U.S., over 30 million worldwide. In the U.S., every 70 seconds, one person develops Alzheimer's disease. And again, the main reason being, right now, the baby boomers are all reaching the ages of 65 and above. So about 10,000 people a day in the U.S. are reaching the age of 65. And that's really when the incidence of Alzheimer's disease starts to increase. And beyond that age of 65, basically the incidence doubles basically every 5 years. So that when you get up to the age of about 85, it's about 40% roughly of the population at that age. The reason being then what's going to happen by 2050 is obviously these numbers that we have, 5.2 million now, that number is going to dramatically increase by the year 2050. And then obviously the backside of that is both the effects of this on families, but then also the financial aspects of this. It's a huge cost to society. The yearly cost right now is about $236 billion. It will go up to roughly around $1 trillion, it's estimated, by the year 2050, unless, again, something changes. So this is the scope of the problem that we're facing. Indiana, obviously, is not immune to this. It's estimated about 110,000 people were diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 2016. That's 14th highest. But this will increase, again, by the year 2025. Huge costs to the state as well. So in terms of Alzheimer's disease, where do we know about it? Really, I'd sort of say we trace back sort of the origins of understanding more about the disease to 1906, which is where Alois Alzheimer, who's shown on the left of the slide here, is a Bavarian neuropathologist, saw sort of what we now know was the sort of the first case of Alzheimer's disease, and that's why his name is associated with it, which was this woman on the right, August Dieter, who came to him with memory impairments, but also a variety of other clinical symptoms. And when she died, he was a neuropathologist, so when she died, he looked in her brain. And we now know sort of the classic hallmark pathologies, neuropathologies that are described for Alzheimer's disease, which are these two. And these are actually quotes from Alois Alzheimer. He said that throughout the whole cortex, which is part of the brain, one finds deposition of a peculiar substance in the cortex. And these today we know are these beta amyloid plaques. That's one of the key hallmark pathologies. And then he also noticed that he called, said there were very peculiar changes in the neurons, and only a tangle of fibrils indicates where a neuron had been previously located. And those are the tau tangles. So if you look over here, the flame-like structures there are actually drawings of Alois Alzheimer, and those are the tangles. And then these round-like structures that stain there with silver are the amyloid plaque. So it's really the definition of those two hallmark pathologies that even today still defines the disease. So what do we think causes Alzheimer's disease? Well, we think that there's multiple, and again, this is common for almost all of the late-life neurodegenerative disorders, multiple genetic, lifestyle, and environmental factors. From studies of twins, it's been estimated that anywhere from 40 to 80%, depending upon the study you look at, are caused by genetic factors. And we've begun, I think, especially recently, begin to understand what a lot of the genetic factors are, and that's really, I think, moved the field forward. The major risk factors, number one risk factor is age. Probably right behind that is family history, but head trauma, and there's other risk factors behind that as well. So there are a few FDA-approved treatments for Alzheimer's disease, and they're listed here. Most of them, what they really do is just slow the progression of the disease, we think. So most of them actually try to increase the amount of acetylcholine because there is a loss of these acetylcholine-based neurons with disease. So these help these neurons basically to survive, we think, a bit longer in the disease. So while they do help, especially at early stages of disease, they by no means stop the disease process from happening. So there's been a lot of work trying to develop disease-modifying therapies instead of the symptom-modifying therapies. And so these are sort of the broad-based strategies that have been utilized in Alzheimer's disease. So the first is strategies trying to target that beta amyloid, which forms the beta amyloid plaques. And so there's a number of different approaches to that, using antibodies that target beta amyloid to try to remove it from the brain. Inhibitors of the secretases, which are enzymes that create the beta amyloid peptide itself, things that inhibit the aggregation of that peptide within the brain. Meanwhile, sort of behind the scenes also, there's a number of groups that are developing anti-tau therapies, again, antibodies to tau, kinase inhibitors. So one of the first steps in development of tau aggregates is the phosphorylation of tau, so that's why kinase inhibitors are used, aggregation inhibitors. But most importantly here, so far, we've not had really a lot of success with any of these that have moved forward. So, for example, on the anti-amyloid therapies, especially over the past couple of years, there have been a couple of failures. There's the antibody solanezumab, which is an antibody to beta amyloid, was in trial by Eli Lilly. That was unsuccessful, at least in the first trial. There's still other trials going on with that compound. Very recently, there were some of these inhibitors for beta secretase, which is one of the key enzymes in the generation of amyloid, which also did not work. So again, I think there's a lot of questions right now as to sort of where we're going and what are we going to focus on next. Again, the failure rate is not good. We've not been very good at defining disease. So I think the big question, I think, as a field that we're trying to figure out is why have we not been very good at designing these trials? Oops. So I think there's a number of different possible reasons. One is it is an age-related disease. It's sort of very difficult to determine what's part of normal aging, what's not part of normal aging, especially in the really old population. There's so many comorbidities with the disease that are occurring simultaneously. We don't have really great diagnostic biomarkers, but again, we'll talk about that. That's improving, I would sort of say, pretty dramatically over the past several years. I would say, especially on some of the early clinical trials, weren't designed terribly well. And the other thing is for the early clinical trials, we didn't have really good biomarkers. So, for example, some of the earliest trials targeting amyloid, all the patients came in just based on memory evaluation, and it was only later determined that about 30% of the patients didn't even have amyloid in their brain when they entered the trial. So, again, if you're targeting amyloid, you would want those patients to have amyloid occurring within the brain. So I think that's completely changed now. The disease of the brain is defined by beta amyloid and tau, but do we really know that those are part of the disease process, or are those just sort of epiphenomena that are occurring? I think that's a big question for the field. There's a huge variation in onset progression and pathology. A lot of the neurologists sort of say if you've seen one Alzheimer's patient, you've seen one Alzheimer's patient, the bottom line. And then finally, and I think this may be the most important at some level, is that brain changes, that these changes in amyloid and tau, sometimes, especially amyloid, can precede the development of clinical symptoms by 20 years. Or 20, even 30 years in some cases. And so this really changes our perspective on the disease of, A, how do we target people, you know, before they develop clinical symptoms and all, how do we do that? And then also it just changes our perspective on the disease, that maybe we don't want to be targeting amyloid if it's occurring 20, 30 years. Maybe we want to be targeting things downstream of amyloid, for example. And then finally, there's been some suggestions that the animal models we have where a lot of these preclinical studies have been done are not great. And that's actually something my group works very hard on, is trying to develop the next generation of animal models that will hopefully be more predictive in terms of obtaining success in clinical trials. So there's been a couple, I'd sort of say, big recent developments in the Alzheimer's disease space that have really, I think, changed both clinical trials and also sort of how we look at the disease. And this is in other types of biomarkers, not the digital biomarkers that we're talking about today, but one is in imaging biomarkers. So there are now ligands for PET that can both identify both amyloid pathology and tau pathology within living patients. And again, this is what has really changed our view of the disease. So, for example, what's shown here is as a compound developed at the University of Pittsburgh, which identifies these amyloid within the brain, and again has led us to understand the disease process in terms of the amyloid deposition starts 20 to 30 years prior to the development of clinical symptoms. Recently, tau ligands have also been developed, and there's several of them out there now, and those are even more, I'd sort of say, impressive, that they seem to also track with disease and actually probably more closely track with clinical symptoms than amyloid certainly does, especially the spread of where tau pathology occurs. So this is, again, one huge advance, I would sort of argue, in terms of the disease. So, for example, all of the clinical trials ongoing right now targeting amyloid have a pre-screen to make sure that the patients have amyloid in the brain. And in addition, we have fluid biomarkers that have started to enter into this space as well, so that the two that have sort of advanced the farthest at this point, although there's certainly a lot of work in this area, are in cerebral spinal fluid, and particularly the levels of beta amyloid and tau. So with progression of disease, amyloid levels in the CSF actually go down because the amyloid is depositing within the brain, so there's less freely available, whereas actually the levels of tau go up with the disease progression. And so it's been shown that you can actually identify people with altered tau levels, and that helps predict that those people are going to go on and develop disease. So again, this has completely also changed sort of our ability to identify patients who are at highest risk to go on to develop disease. And then finally, and I just show one example of this because I know we're going to have a lot more discussion about this today. People have started to look at what we call digital biomarkers in the Alzheimer's space. I'd sort of say it's really in its infancy. So this was a study from Jeff Kay and colleagues where they were monitoring everything from walking to computer use or all variety of things, again, using sort of just continuous monitoring. And they were able to identify in a stage of early Alzheimer's disease called mild cognitive impairment that they could already see differences in that group compared to controls in this one study. And there's other studies looking at other effects as well. And I see I'm running low on time, so I may just skip this. But this basically shows that they were able to identify basically a subset of patients that had mild cognitive impairment, and again, based on some of these trajectories that were obtained. And furthermore, they then made some calculations about how much clinical size they would need in order to use that as a biomarker for clinical trials. And so, again, I think this is really just beginning to happen in the Alzheimer's space. But I think really why this completely, in my mind, is really important is actually last Friday, the FDA commissioner put out sort of a drug review program in terms of how we're going to move forward, especially in the neuroscience space. And in particular, for Alzheimer's disease, he said in stage one patients, and these are patients who have the brain pathology but yet don't have any of the clinical symptoms, that an effect on the characteristic pathophysiologic changes of AD, as demonstrated by an effect on various biomarkers, can be measured, and this effect, analyzed by a primary efficacy measure, may in principle serve as the basis for accelerated approval by the FDA. And this is, I think, really significant because, again, right now we've sort of been struggling with, you know, if the disease progress is 20 years, how do you design a clinical trial based on, again, the typical clinical measures, which is memory impairments? So this suggests that potentially you may be able to use biomarkers if you can show that the biomarkers ultimately then track in terms of clinical measures. So I will skip this since I ran out of time. This is, I was just going to tell you about the Salk Institute. We're about a mile down the road here. So if you want to come, we have research going on neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's disease, from basic science all the way to clinical trials. But we also have work going on in traumatic brain injury, addiction, neuropsychiatric disorders, et cetera. And with that, I think I'm right on time. And thank you. And I think we'll do a panel at the end, so just write your questions down that you have.
Thank you. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I could have hardly asked for better presentations to follow. You've got different debilitating diseases, you know, significant change over time, whether it's a long trajectory or a long time frame or a short time frame, change from a personal baseline, and then the need or opportunity to quantify these changes in a way that's specific to a patient and accounts for the various trajectories that these patients are going through. Now, what we focus on at PhysIQ is how to take the data that's available from wearable biosensors to make sense of how a patient's physiology might demonstrate how they're doing. And this could be in the context of actually getting clinical treatment or in the context of clinical trials. But in general, our thesis, our business thesis overall at PhysIQ is that you've got this evolving ecosystem of wearable biosensors, but it's really the need on the analytical side to make sense of the data that presents the biggest opportunity to transform how patients are cared for and how clinical trials are run. So what we do at PhysIQ is at our core, we're an analytics company, but we have a platform and an end-to-end solution that allows us to capture data from wearable biosensors, transmit it to the cloud. It's in the cloud that we apply our analytics, and then we provide that information to either clinicians or to researchers who can benefit from these analytics in the context of their role. Now, we work with a lot of different biosensors, but we really like the clinical grade biosensors like the one I've got here. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this. This is a company called Vital Connect, or from a company called Vital Connect. This is a wearable patch, the single lead ECG. This continuously streams heart rate, respiration rate, and the waveform data to the cloud, and that's where we apply our analytics. Now, as I mentioned, we provide that information to clinicians. But then we also are able to provide that information to researchers in the context of their work. So it starts with the raw waveform data. Right? All these sensors are capturing some sort of data, whether it's PPG sensor or ECG sensor or accelerometer. From there, we derive features, right? So the first set of activities that our algorithms do is to take an ECG and generate heart rate, respiration rate, or use PPG to generate the same. And from there, we're able to capture a lot of different aspects of human physiology. But then from those features, we can then also extract actual physiological insight, right? So being able to identify ectopic beats, be able to quantify sleep, sleep apnea, AFib, suspected orthopnea, other characteristics of physiology that can help in determining how a patient might be doing. But beyond that, and this is really where our secret sauce is applied, is in personalizing for a patient to detect change from their own personal baseline. So if you think about the opportunity with continuous data, right? You have continuous heart rate, continuous respiration rate, continuous activity. When you plot that out, it looks like this. As you might imagine, all of us have a physiological signature of some sort, right? And there is a relationship between these different variables that kind of characterize our cardiopulmonary physiology, right? So if we all jumped up right now, which I won't ask you to do, and did 15 jumping jacks, we very likely would have very different heart rates and very different respiration rates. And that's what our machine learning analytics are really characterizing. So the way that this works is that we take the first at least 48 hours of data coming from a device for an individual and apply our artificial intelligence to that data to establish a baseline for that individual. So what we're doing is we're characterizing the relationship between heart rate and respiration rate and activity for each person. Now, we like a minimum of 48 hours because we want to see at least a diurnal cycle for that individual. What does heart rate look like when somebody's walking around? What does heart rate look like when they're standing in front of an audience giving a presentation or sleeping or what have you? And it's through that that we're able to understand how that individual's physiology works in the real world. And that's really one of the key challenges of making sense of sensor data, right? How do you account for the inherent variability, the daily variability in vital signs, and how do you account for the person-to-person variability? Because what is normal for one person is not normal for the other. So, you know, as Dr. Land noted, if you've seen one patient, you've seen one patient. And that's actually very, very true, physiologically speaking. And so what we do is, by virtue of establishing this baseline and then transitioning from learning mode into monitoring mode, we're able to detect very subtle changes that manifest. And these changes can manifest from disease progression, disease exacerbation, or they can manifest from change in therapy. And so in that regard, what you see here, we're not operating in the realm of absolute value for an individual parameter. Rather, we're looking at the delta between what's learned for that individual and what they happen to be presenting. So it doesn't matter, if you will, whether or not somebody's heart rate is 120 beats per minute or 70 beats per minute at a given moment in time. Rather, what we're looking at is the heart rate 78 beats per minute, but based on everything we know about that individual, it actually should be 67 beats per minute, right? Because it's those three beats that start to indicate a physiological change that has extracted the signal from the noise of everything else that's going on. So this is a really key aspect of what we do in our approach to analytics. And then lastly, and this applies mostly to clinicians who are managing patient populations, we don't want to have to ask them to look at all these different parameters individually. I mean, data overload is already a problem in healthcare. And so what we do is we roll up the change across the various parameters that we're measuring to indicate how a patient is doing relative to their baseline by virtue of an index. We call it our multivariate change index. And so this is a process, analytical process, that happens in the cloud. It's all automated, and it is FDA clear, and we are applying this to different use cases. So in a clinical trial capacity, operating model that we use is to apply a patch or apply any kind of sensor to a patient for a certain period of time. As you might imagine, the longer time we have of learning data, the higher fidelity personalized model we can create. I mentioned we want at least 48 hours, but you know, I'll have an example in here where we had a much longer training period. And then from there, going forward, we apply same sensors to be able to monitor that patient over time so that we can detect these changes. So an example from, so this is an example patient from a data set that we're going to be presenting at American College of Cardiology here in a couple of weeks. This was a heart failure study where patients were discharged from the hospital and provided 90 days worth of patches, and we gave them a phone, and it was observational study. So nobody was actually monitoring the data in real time. Rather, what we were doing was capturing the data in the background and then via retrospective reconciliation, looking at that in the context of the actual medical record. So the idea was, let's validate that what the analytics detect and how early in the process the analytics are capable of detecting the event. So in this regard, you know, the goal was actually to let standard of care take its course. And out of the 100 patients that we monitored, you know, the idea was that there would be a certain subset that would exacerbate. They would go back to the hospital, and we wanted to see what our analytics were capable of detecting for that individual. And so this is an example of one patient. I'll give away the punchline. This patient was readmitted to the hospital on September 17. They were discharged earlier that month. I mentioned we have that initial training period, so we've got heart rate, a plot of heart rate, respiration rate, and activity here. That's the data set that then our analytics use to build a personalized model with estimates for this patient. So you see those estimates here in orange. And for the first 5 or 6 days after this patient was discharged from the hospital, you can see that their physiology was behaving as the system expected, right? There's not much difference between that diurnal cycle that you see in these different parameters. But then as that patient gets closer and closer to that hospital readmission, we can see a decoupling of these parameters from their baseline. Now, these are pretty small changes in heart rate and respiration rate. If you were to look at this just in the context of person-to-person variability or normal variability throughout the day, this would be hard to pull out. So by virtue of personalizing, we're able to zero in on changes that are relevant for that patient. And so what we're seeing here is actual, you know, compensation within the cardiopulmonary control loop that ultimately predicted, if you will, this heart failure exacerbation, and did so a week plus in advance. And then when that patient was rehospitalized, treated for their heart failure, you can see that they return back to their baseline. I mentioned earlier that, you know, what our goal is to provide clinicians with a tool that's easy to use. And so here's how this looks in the, with respect to that index, right? Where we see that deterioration in the form of greater air, you know, more blue, if you will, greater density of that index, and then you can see the ultimate improvement. Now, thinking about this in the context of clinical trials, right? We've got these new data sets that offer, you know, 24/7 data to validate or identify things that otherwise would be done through, you know, relatively coarse measures like the 6-minute walk test. So if you think about a 6-minute walk test, patient's going to come in every 3 months or whatever the protocol requires. The idea is to, you know, establish a baseline for that patient and then be able to detect change over time. Now, you don't have a lot of data points, and so the ability to actually distinguish between populations in terms of therapeutic impact requires you to have much larger data set to establish effect size. Now, rather than doing something like a 6-minute walk test, if you were able to just put a sensor on a patient and capture data all the time, you have much greater density of data, and therefore you start to have more greater data set by which to then establish differences that could be clinically meaningful. And so here we've got, you know, a plotted heart rate over time. But if you were actually able to take that to the next level and personalize and focus on that residual for that patient, where each patient is their own control, the potential impact there is then you have a smaller population required to demonstrate the same effect size. And this is really kind of the core of what we're focused on in our clinical trials business. Now, in addition then to the objective physiological data, there is still opportunity to capture subjective data. So I mentioned we have the biosensor. That sensor transmits via app to the cloud. It's that same app that we are deploying your traditional patient-reported outcomes so that we can then marry the subjective with the objective. And this is what really lends itself to the opportunity to establish these different biomarkers across different diseases. Now, some examples here across other therapeutic areas. So I showed you that heart failure example earlier. It's fairly obvious and intuitive that you would see changes in heart rate and changes in respiration rate in something like heart failure. But this is a patient who actually had severe pain episodes, where same thing applies, right? We're personalizing on a subset of data. You've got heart rate and respiration rate plotted over time. From that personalized model, we're generating these estimates that you see here. And it's interesting how then you start to see changes from that baseline at certain periods of this timeline for this patient. Now, when we then look at the patient-reported events, we actually see a correlation or a relationship between changes in heart rate and changes in respiration rate that preceded these pain events. And then layering on even more information, we learn that this patient was, this is all retrospective, right? We learn that this patient was transitioned from opioid-based pain therapy to non-opioid. And you can actually see manifest in the cardiopulmonary control loop significant changes in heart rate and respiration rate. And it's also important to note that these are changes that are occurring not just at the limits of heart rate, but throughout the full spectrum of activity that you see during the day. And then as you might imagine, with these pain events, you also see decreased activity, just further evidence of what's available with these biocenters. I've actually run out of time here, so I'm going to run through one last example. This is an oncology study. The goal here is to use sensor data to be able to identify chemotherapy-related toxicity. Toxicity is a huge problem, both in clinical trials and obviously as well as patient treatment. Same idea, heart rate. In this case, we've got heart rate variability and respiration rate. We apply our machine learning to baseline a patient. We did this over 72 hours. From there, we have estimates. And then this patient also went through a bone marrow transplant during that same period of time. And then looking at then changes for that patient, particularly related to respiration rate and heart rate variability. And retrospectively, we see that, and this is how it's manifest in terms of the index, we then find out that this patient was diagnosed with bacteremia, where we had multiple days advance warning. So if you think about a patient who's undergoing chemotherapy, the ability to actually identify something like this has opportunity to improve their ability to tolerate that medication. And then beyond the very sophisticated, personalized work that we do, there's also some more rudimentary analytics that are possible with these data sets. So if we look at daily mean respiration during high activity, right, so we're basically filtering out low activity, just looking at respiration when patients are very active, we can see that, we can see a clear opportunity to measure changes relevant for that patient with respect to their treatment. And I will cycle through the rest of these. Same idea because I'm out of time. So lots of opportunity to actually pull out insight. We are applying this to oncology, anti-cancer treatment, pain detection. We've got multiple clinical trials underway, hundreds of patients where we're capturing these data for these various therapeutic areas, cardiopulmonary efficiency, CNS disorders, and then obviously heart failure. So thanks again for the opportunity to talk, and I will turn it over to Dan now.
Thanks, Chris. So again, thank you everyone for being here, and thank you for the speakers who went in front of me. At this point, what I want to do is sort of wrap up a little bit with IBRI, some of the things we're doing in the space, what we think the challenges are coming ahead, and then hopefully get to questions so you can talk more about this emerging area. So because I always think that there's people here who may not know IBRI or understand what we're doing here, I want to go briefly through a little bit in terms of IBRI. And we really are working to build a new institute for research innovation, where we had the coffee and bagels, if you look out there. In the future, we hope that will be an innovation park that we have, and IBRI will be the anchor for it. And what you're seeing actually with Indianapolis is a report just came out about a week ago in terms of from BioCrossroads, the leadership in Indiana, the decisions that have made for decades, as really positioning Indianapolis and Indiana as a place to really drive research tech, and we hope that IBRI will be a key piece of that as we go forward to really work between the strong life sciences organizations we have and the emerging tech and IT community to really solve challenging problems. So IBRI, relatively young, that's why we're still building visibility and credibility, was really started at Life Sciences Summit by John Lechleiter calling for the creation of IBRI to really drive innovation within the state and between the various organizations, academic, commercial, and the startup communities. So over the course of the past about five to six years, continued to be funded, continued to grow, continued to staff as we do, and you're in a piece of this now at this early stage. This year, we will see substantial growth based upon our five-year strategic plan where we will more than double and then continue to grow as we go forward. So, but what are we trying to do? Our mission is not to be everything to everybody, but to really work between the substrates and the capabilities we have here. And so our mission really is to be an independent, industry-led, applied research institute, to take things from early stages, translate them to value to a commercial entities, to patients, to consumers in terms of this, to deliver innovative solutions, and because of both the need at the state as well as our corporate partners, primarily in the early areas of metabolic, cardiovascular health, diabetes, and nutrition. So we really want to be that place in the midst of everything in Indiana where we can really connect people, connect capabilities, convene, catalyze, collaborate. And we've already been showing that we can do that in this context as we drive forward with multiple collaborations with the life sciences partners, with small tech, with the academic institutions as well. So where are we at the moment? Reiner had accepted about a year ago, has joined this past year in terms here, and so he acts as our CEO and Chief Scientific and Innovation Officer. At this point, we have three what we call core competencies, metabolic regenerative medicine led by Teresa Mastracci, Mike Puja leading single cell analytics and diagnostics, and after my on loan to Lilly when it became permanent here at IBRI, I'm driving the applied science and analytics in here. Based upon the five-year plan, we will be moving into new areas, and we're staffing into new areas that we think are critical to drive life sciences as we go forward. So where do we apply this, though? We're applying it into the business fields, as stated, in cardiometabolic health. Digital health as a key thing in terms of where we think we can drive innovation, and then ultimately moving into nutrition based upon our five-year plan. So what I want to delve a little bit more then into is how we think about, and it really came up in terms of the talks before, how do we think about disease and health? We focus on disease. We also focus on thinking of the opposite, that health. How do we maintain healthy states or in disease states? How do we move back to this? And especially when you talk about cardiometabolic disease, it is a lot of different factors that are there. In some monogenetic diseases, it may be highly genetic of origin. In others, like cardiometabolic disease, you may actually be genetically predisposed, but there's a huge amount of the disease that comes from human, the environment, your behaviors, not just genetic, but how does that translate into the biology that's going on in your body? And so Eric Topol, who's been driving some of these earliest things in terms of, I think, sensors and otherwise, and how we do medicine and health differently, sort of looks across all of the types of different things you have to understand and potentially integrate to understand human health. For us, we looked at similarly, yes, you need to understand the biological factors, what's happening in deep biology, what's happening at a personal level, but we also think very much that it also is the socioeconomic, geographic, clinical, behavioral. What is happening in where you live, what you do on a daily basis, that over long term also has your health. So as you go from your genomic predisposition through the various capabilities of our biology, that has a huge amount of influence on the environment you live and the behaviors you have. So really to understand human health and to change human health, we have to think across all these dimensions and more. And so we think that there's really an opportunity to go not only between organizations, but between data sources, integrate them, and understand how we go forward. So in this talk, in this session, we are talking more about digital health, IoT, biosensors, Internet of Things. You're seeing a lot of these things where edge computing, other buzzwords, will be coming in terms here and including digital biomarkers. How do we understand that component? So we think that really within Indiana, there's a real opportunity to make a difference, use the substrate of what we have, both Indiana and, thanks, Chris, the regional areas that surround us in terms of how to make a difference. And so you've seen a piece of this. As we go into digital health, as we go into digital biomarkers or otherwise, there's lots of challenges, especially in the health side. We know it, data security, talked about here, HIPAA high tech if you're in the European GDPR in terms there. So, yes, data security is paramount. Actually, there's concerns that we are overdoing data security at the expense of meaningful use of that data to really drive problems going forward. Talked about here, issues are data quality. And I'll show in the next, after this build, a cautionary tale. We need to think about the data quality in terms of what we are generating. How do we think about that? How do we validate, just like we would any other scientific method or tool, that we are consistently, reproducibly generating that? And that's at a test level. Once we have really good validated digital data, as Chris showed some of, then how do we translate that into its impact or association with disease state, because then it actually can become a diagnostic, something that can be used to understand patient-level information in a new way and drive new therapies or behavioral, depending if you're clinical or outcomes-based. And so we need to think about how do we validate these ones. And once you get into validation of signals for patients, then you have to think about what's this the patient cohort, what's the size of patients, what is the quantity of data, of valid data you need per validation at those disease states. That's about the statistical power in terms of this. So if you think about it, the way I decouple it in terms of thinking about it is really you think about from scientifically, what's the device, what's the test that you're using, that we have to do all the time in science or technology that we're doing. We need to validate that. We need to make sure it works well. It may be baseline to various individuals, and then think about disease relevance. So moving forward, what we've been doing likewise, because of early identification of digital biomarkers as being a case, we've actually worked a small tech partner to generate a platform for secure digital data similar to where Chris was talking about. We didn't go the biosensors route. We've actually gone more to what you can capture from a smartphone and looking at the various signals that you can, both from, yes, we need to access subjective data, surveys, standard measures, those type things. Yes, there are activity tests that you can have people do, like the walk test or otherwise, to do those type things. But then also, as you go into other types of disease states, mental illness, cognitive decline, neurodegenerative pain, or otherwise, can you actually look at other signals around them? Are they moving? Are they going around? Are they active on social media? Are they doing other things? Could be actually signals, if validated, in terms of understanding someone's state. Do they feel pain? Are they feeling response from pain? Are they going into depressed state? Are they going into issues with cognitive decline? So we have a platform in terms of doing this that may be used for commercial use. At IBRI, we're really focused on how do we drive those innovation exploratory ones in terms of this. And we're at the point where we're working on in terms of capturing those digital signals under IRB, under protocols, observational studies, and our expectation is both working with comprehensive pain specialists in Nashville, as well as with Indiana University School of Medicine. We'll have data that's captured, observational, help us understand the system, start building the baselines. Chris's organization is ahead of us a little bit. We're going more into what we think are the unmet diseases in terms of that. So now my cautionary tale. We see all these things on if you're looking from a business side, you'll see everything. This is not the headline we want to see for our organizations. Five lessons learned from a botched trial, right? So those are, lots of times you want good press. You don't want the negative press. All good intentions in here. If you look at this, basically strong, highly recognized MGH Cleveland Clinic. Sorry, Bruce, I know there's connection there. In terms of Texas Children, in terms there. But they ran a clinical trial, and at the end of the time, they said because of procedural anomalies, the data was all but useless, right? What a waste. Their premise was smartphone-based respiratory analysis software, record the cough sound and link it to a disease state. They did it in the ones. They built the AI. They built the machine learning. Everything worked great. They moved ahead rapidly. They were getting ready to go it in FDA, and it fell apart. And so the unexpected issues with the clinical data. So why? I'm not going to talk about the five lessons learned here, but really, there was a lack of assay reproducibility, the tests. In noisy environments or otherwise, and the variability of the smartphones and what they were doing, the data was very variable. In fact, a lot of the data, they couldn't actually use their machine learning algorithms on it. There was protocol issues. People didn't know how to integrate this. This was the setup of the clinical trial that was talked about by Maurice and Bruce, in terms of how do we set up the clinical trials right. There is technology issues. As you're bringing any new technology into the environment, do they know how to use it and do it? There was inclusion criteria. You didn't have enough power. And so even though you had top-tier, experienced research hospitals, people who had worked in this space, new technology, were not able to compensate this. Huge amount, they've had to rework, they're going back, it'll be in clinical trials coming up in terms there. So what I want to use that for is really as we go into digital health, there is a huge amount of promise, hype, right, overselling that may go on. But we understand, we know it's going to change. It's absolutely going to change. And so when you go from population statistics, which is great, down to personal level, you have to be very careful at a personal level. You do no harm, right, that you provide benefit for the individuals in terms of their. We need to make sure as we go from the IoT, the biosensors, the data, as Chris showed, as we go to the algorithms, machine learning, AI, or otherwise determined in them, that each of those components are validated, tested, standard scientific principles, standard engineering principles, and how we go. And then ultimately, we absolutely know we're going to get to where we can deliver insights and decisions to disease in a different way. So trying to wrap up and anticipate what my colleagues would be talking about, we absolutely know our current healthcare system is going to be disrupted by technology. We just cannot predict where or when or how it's going to come. It'll be unexpected time. Disruptive technology is that way. We need to be skeptical about the hype. Don't assume that just because someone stated the facts, that everything is there to do it. The rigor needs to be there for the science, the technology, as we go forward. Sometimes we need to go a little slower to actually go past faster in the future, right? The cautionary tale, they wanted to move fast. In the end, they actually wasted a whole bunch of time and money, where if a little more work in advance. And then finally, which was the context of this and this one, is really to drive the needs, drive the capabilities. We really need to operate across research and collaborations. And from my perspective, we think IBRI or the Indiana environment or the regional environment we have is primed to really allow us to drive those things forward under the right circumstances, and to drive this exploratory work, scientific rigor, and drive it to really the benefit of all. At that point, I'm going to close, and then I think Vanessa was going to come up, and I'm sorry.
I missed for time. So, yep. So I think we're going to have all the speakers come up for a panel conversation. So thank you, Dan. So great conversation. Some themes that I kind of took away from there, just kind of trying to let people bring their thoughts together and the questions they want to ask as I make demanding eye contact with the audience members, was that we really are in infancy in this space, that we, I get the feeling there's a lot going on, but it's really hard to tell the quality of the actions taking place in the digital biomarker space. So I don't know, when I think about this, if I were a clinician, you know, what keeps you up at night? What do you get really excited about, and what are you like, oh my gosh, what if that happened? Do you guys have any hot button topics in this space that you're really concerned about? I mean, Dan highlights kind of the botch study example. Have you seen some really impressive personalized outcomes in this space that you think need to be highlighted about, the risk is really worth it?
I'll push it down the line. So.
You ask the clinicians?
I'm asking the clinicians, yeah. What do you
see? I think the answer is embedded in your question. We are in the infancy in this terrain, and never before we had the opportunity to really explore this technology, and we had a great example here, because today we have price of the technology that's extremely low, we have a reduction in size, and we have the possibility of a connection between different data banks and devices and everything, because internet is and will be even faster in the future as never before. So basically, what are we dealing with here now? Medicine is a language, right? A diseased body communicates to physicians, pharma, whatever, using a language, right? The heart language or whatever. And what physicians do, they understand this language, and they use this language and translate that into English. It is Alzheimer's. Right? So we translate this into something understandable, okay? Nothing is more suitable to those technologies than perhaps neurology because of the extension of that language. And you can take every single symptom and sign and think about it being an opportunity for a new way of exploring these and having some sort of technology helping in the way the disorder is detected, or even better, anticipated. And we can act preventively in a much better way. And this will impact profoundly the way trials are designed, and also the way treatments will be delivered in the future. I don't know if I touched what you asked. But,
And I think from to build on that a little bit, I think that really it's that translation and how do you turn it into the insights, as Chris talked about, as the decisions are going, and how do you do it in a context where you have fail-safes available, right, so that you're not doing these. So what is the role of the physician, right, in some of these as they're going? What's the role in an expert looking at the data, assisting make the call before we get to a point of really having everything validated? And I think it goes across all of those. What do we do in a clinical sense to validate? What do we do it in an outcome sense? How do we work carefully? In some respects, I've talked a lot with Covance and Dante Landucci. Lots of times technology companies are driving these forwards without really the expertise of medical physicians or otherwise on their helping understand, without always an understanding of what happens in a clinical setting or clinical environment. And so that's why I think it's actually across multiple organizations that you need to drive some of these capabilities, these tests, and do it in sort of phased clinical trials. We know there will be issues, right? Any new therapeutics, we can be surprised by the science, right? So how do you set it up in a way so we learn as we go?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the use case. So this is a talk about digital biomarkers, right, which inherently would suggest that it's about diagnosing. I don't think we're there yet in terms of you using digital biomarkers to definitively and accurately and scalably, that's a word, diagnose. Our approach really is you've got a use case where there are a lot of at-risk patients out there. You've got clinicians who are actually quite good at identifying or taking care of those patients when they're identified, right? What we're focused on is doing that initial triage. Right? So our software, our analytics, they're not saying that it's this versus this, it's heart failure versus pneumonia versus COPD. Rather, what we're focused on is this person is different than they were 3 weeks ago or 3 months ago. So if you're managing 500 patients who have been discharged from the hospital over the last 90 days, these are the four or five or six that you should be calling today. And then they've got their arsenal of tools to identify what actually might be wrong with that patient. I think we will ultimately get to a point where we will be diagnosing, okay, here's a patient, they're at risk, and we think it's pneumonia, or we think it's COPD, or we think it's something else. But our approach is to give baby steps to get there.
But even I would argue those baby steps, I think, could have huge impact. I mean, just because, again, if you can reliably do that, identify somebody. For example, there's been some work done on gait and risk of a fall that I think looks pretty encouraging. Again, it's still early stage, but if you could identify somebody, for example, who is at really high risk for a fall and then intervene in some way, that could have a huge benefit, both in terms of the patient and the cost, because otherwise if that patient then gets into a nursing home and everything else that's downstream typically of a fall.
And along those lines, I mean, it's interesting. With digital, there's opportunities to tune algorithms. Right? I mentioned the data that we'll be presenting at ACC here in a few weeks. So we have ROC curves that will show our relationship between the sensitivity and specificity. And the question is, what do you want to solve for that clinician? Right, we can go all the way on one end of the spectrum where we're going to catch everything and every patient, but there's going to be a high false positive rate, right? Then the other question is, do you want a clinician to have a tool where when he or she sees an issue, they are very, very confident it's there? Well, by virtue of that, you've got to dial it back, and you're not going to catch everything, but you're going to have a high degree of confidence. But you can dial back and forth along that IRLC curve to identify what that sweet spot is relative to the use case.
I think that's going to be one piece that's difficult, is how much risk are people willing to take to kind of set that threshold. But I'm going to direct over to the audience because I think I saw somebody hand go up. Okay.
Well, so we have focused solely on the observational studies like the data that I shared. We are transitioning right now from the observational into the interventional, where we're actually giving this as a tool to clinicians to manage these populations. I don't know yet. These clinicians are seeing things that they've never seen before. Nobody's had, 90 days of continuous heart rate or 90 days of a continuous respiration rate. I think they're going to see things that they've never seen, and it has potential to be an amazingly powerful tool, but it also has potential to overwhelm. So we have to be very careful around how we educate and how we give them give this to them as a tool. So I don't know, from a year from now, I'll probably be able to give you a better answer.
And I'd say the same thing. We're at the early stages in terms of understanding this. If you look at clinical trials and how you do these, especially in digital biomarkers, there's always a concern of the placebo effect, a concern of are you actually changing things in terms of this. In a clinical trial where you're trying to study various arms and try and keep things as consistently, actually you want to not try and change the behavior of the individual doing as much. The moment you go into clinical outcomes or clinical decision or otherwise, actually there's a huge motivational behavior to say, how do you train the physicians to use this? How do you monitor the patients? How do you use this as a way going? And so it really comes back to the use case in terms of what problem are you trying to solve at that point. But absolutely, as we think about cardiometabolic, there's a huge amount of effort going on. That's why we steered a little bit away from it in cardiometabolic health, in terms of diabetes management, otherwise, where there's a huge component of the training, not only of the physicians in terms of doing this, which we do need in new technology platforms, but also in how you use it for motivation and behavioral change in the individuals so they're making those right changes. So you see that coming as a point, but it does depend upon, is it a diagnostics used in sort of a support of a clinical trial? What is the use? And not everything is done exactly the same way. It depends upon the use case, disease state, or how connected, some respects, your diagnostics, digital or otherwise, is to, to the true, or are we really on this exploratory arm where we are with Alzheimer's or otherwise, where in fact, when I saw Jan Lundberg present a while ago, one of the concerns with some of the Lilly trials was, did you have sensitive enough measures to really understand the changes that were occurring to be able to say you can meet those? So it's not an easy answer. So
I think there are educational, I think, efforts underway. I mean, the NIH is really pushing sort of educational initiatives, especially on big data more generally. And I think so most the medical institutions, like IE School of Medicine, we're trying to integrate this into the curriculum. It's also at a very early stage, I would argue, in terms of the education side. What should we be educating people on, and how should we be doing that, and what does that look like? But again, there's discussions ongoing right now across all of the medical institutions on that side as well.
So I'm going to redirect. I think we had a question over here. Two? Yeah.
So I'd like to bring up the concept of data quality.
Yeah.
Right? Because data for the sake of data is dumb data unless you have context, unless you have insight.
Yeah.
Right? So what we're getting towards is the need, at the risk of spurious logic when we get into things like artificial intelligence,
right,
connecting disparate dots on things, the need for things around standards in our training data. We're talking about sufficient reproducibility, intertest reliability, intra-test reliability, and to solve the problem, but also, can we come to, as an industry, as scientists, right, come to an agreement on what quality training data needs to be? I'd like you guys to just talk about that, because I feel as though the solutions we're getting into only end up being as strong as we teach the algorithms to decide, to go from raising a red flag to pointing at a problem.
So before you answer, I'm going to say that we are at the top of the hour, but I think we're okay to continue the conversation. So if people do need to get up and move on to their next event today, that's fine. But otherwise, let's keep the dialogue going.
So let me hit that briefly, because that's always a concern in terms of us, in terms of data quality. And 10 years ago, we were doing 10, even more than that, early predictive models within Eli Lilly. And honestly, when you had bad data, it didn't really matter. You couldn't pull out a signal. The moment you had good quality data, actually the signals would start dropping out. The test training, cross-validation, all of those have to be place things we should absolutely be concerned about reproducibility of data. With a predictive model, sometimes you could actually start seeing when our biological assays were shifting that were not even caught from there. What I will say, it's also not just big data. People think about just throwing big data on it. You've actually increased the ability to find correlations or spurious correlations. The analogy I have from one of key individuals is, if you're looking for a needle in a haystack, don't keep throwing more hay on top, right? You've just made the problem worse. How do we make the problem easier to solve? Better data, better quality.
You touched the center of the scientific method. We are not going to use those things because they are cool. They are very cool, by the way. They have to be useful. And to prove this, you don't have just to establish the technology or use the technology and validate it. You have to reproduce it. It has to be reproducible and consistent. And then it becomes a valuable thing. And then you reach the quality of data. So there's a process in all that. And science has all tools to, you know, go through this process to allow us using this technology in a good way. I became a physician before MRI was available or common. And this technology changed completely the way we understood a lot of diseases. And we understand them today. Right? It took at the time to understand all that. And today something very interesting is happening in the neuroimaging space. The speed of new neuroimaging technologies is so vast and quick that a new sequence or tool emerges before we even have the time to understand all the potentials of the previous technology. So it goes so fast. So there are a lot of, you know, new ways to address imaging the body in different ways that we don't even understand all the possibilities and ways this can be used. And I think the same will happen in the digital biomarkers and these sort of technologies. It will require time for us to understand the potentials and how they can be used in all branches of medicine.
I think we had one more question in the audience at least.
I don't mean to add more complication, but there is a point to be made about environment by genotype interaction, and that my question is really, where do you guys think we are? Are we progressing towards apps that can capture exposure, both from eating, from breathing, and being exposed in the environment, to how we respond physiologically? And I'm thinking about migraine as a great example of some of those pieces that could elicit a migraine episode. So is there a push to try to marry both the environment and exposure piece to the physiological piece? Because I think we would be missing a lot if we didn't do that.
You touch migraine, so we'll try to answer this question. Of course, definitely yes. Migraine is also influenced by genetic factors, by the way. If you have either a father or mother suffering from migraine, you may have up to 2.5 higher chances to develop migraine in your life. There's a genetic component there. And if you consider the trigger factors, the environment plays a lot in this, or may play a lot in this context. So if you can think a situation where you detect things before the migraine attack is about to occur, and you correlate this with changes where the person is, how the weather is, and lots of other things we haven't even imagined yet. This may enrich and perhaps contribute to our ability to predict an attack and act preventively.
But to your point, there's lots of hardware being developed, right, that you can just clip into your phone. I mean, for the people left, how many of you have a Fitbit on? Your Apple Watch? Your smartphone? You think about, there are lots of individuals who will have breathalyzers attached to their cell phones, and they may not have the highest quality data, but this idea of, okay, I'm going to be, responsible, proactive, and check myself if I've had a beverage at the bar. To your point, you're sampling something from yourself, but you can easily sample from your surroundings. And I think with everybody carrying these devices
you know, wearables, the increase in the sensitivity and specificity of the sensors, I think there are a lot of things in the environment that you would want to continually monitor and along with those physiological measures. That's one of the questions I had for you is also, and I won't make him answer my question, just all the different sensors out there and how they get validated. And, you know, you showed the measurements around respiration and heart rate, but there's so many other things you can measure and so many other sensors, and how do you take those through the rigorous training data sets and processes so that they are, you know, FDA approved, so that physicians feel comfortable, pharma feels comfortable, how do you get everybody in that common platform so that then we can share the data?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things we look at in terms of how do we pool data together, how do we generate better data, how do when we find observations, are they just observations as opposed to that we immediately jump and assume that they're validated and correlated, and how do we show a little bit more rigorous? I do think we're in a time of dramatic change, which is going to happen. That makes our job, I think, worse or more difficult, right? Because, you know, there's going to be that hype, and for all of us, we sort of have to think about, okay, how do we put the science behind it when the technology is moving so much faster than the science at this point? So
out of respect for the individuals who also have a day job in this building, I think we need to get off the mics and start to wrap it up, but I'm sure we can also move out into the common space if there are individuals who want to continue the conversation. And then I would just put one last word in, that if you're having fun and you like the conversation, come back in the March-April timeframe. I know that we are working on the next BioCrossroads frameworks, and we hope to see some familiar and maybe some new faces, so bring a friend along. So thanks.
Thanks.
Great way to kick the day off.
Yep. Thank you.